Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there. Today, we're speaking with Nicole Connor, a partner at Airbus Ventures. Airbus Ventures is a global fund investing in early stage companies impacting the aerospace industry. So Nicole, thanks for joining us today. We always love the opportunity to speak to a fellow VC that is personally based in the DC area. You are a lawyer by training and had started at Airbus Ventures on the legal counsel side and recently transitioned into an investing role, which is really exciting. Tell us about that journey and what led you to want to make that transition and pursue a career in venture capital.
Absolutely. And thanks so much for having me here today. It's a pleasure to have this conversation. My role into Airbus Ventures and the process, I think like most folks, was very circuitous and certainly nonlinear. I started my career at White & Case in New York and was drawn to doing that because I've always wanted to work on international deals. And at the time, I didn't really know what that meant and what that could look like, but it evolved along the way. I started out doing debt deals on the lender side, moved to borrower side financing, then VC financing, private equity financing. And as you mentioned, started working with Airbus Americas and their legal team, primarily because they were inundated with so many deals that Airbus Ventures was doing. Probably on average, we're doing about 15 deals a year. And it was a great opportunity to get a chance to know the team from that angle first, overseeing their transactions, and then also structured their most recent fund. And in that process, started fundraising as well with the team. And through that, there was just this gravitational pull that I felt towards Airbus Ventures and the team. It's a really dynamic group full of interesting characters with fascinating backgrounds. And that relationship that we built over working together just naturally led to us realizing that there was a perfect fit for me within the team. So I continue to do all of those things. I still oversee all of the transactions that we do globally, or still the process of fundraising with the team, and then also oversee my own portfolio companies as well.
And so what drew you to the investing side?
I knew that I always wanted to have the business hat. I think like a lot of lawyers, you get the bug. You really want to be the person who's building the relationships and building out the teams and building the companies yourself in this hands-on role. And this really allowed me the opportunity to do that and work with sleeves rolled up with our startup founders. And as we all know, it's a tremendous amount of work to take a company from seed stage and to help them grow and hire and expand and do contracts with massive corporations and sovereigns. And so it's been a great opportunity to explore all of those with our founders.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And do you personally focus on any particular sectors of interest, or how does that work?
So our team takes a system approach. We don't have any sort of vertical that we individually oversee. We believe that there is a tremendous amount of benefit that comes from us all using our skill sets to both source and vest and then oversee the portfolio. So our team is global. We have our headquarters are in Sand Hill Road. We have an office in Tokyo. We have an office in Toulouse. As you noted, I'm sitting in DC, but we have folks in Munich and Paris as well. And all of that is to help us identify these exciting startups that fit within our investment thesis. We all work collectively when we're bringing them on board and then all using our respective skill sets once they're part of the portfolio. With the legal skill set, I try and help our portfolio companies work on their commercial contracts, helping them grow, scale. With all of the financing background I have, thinking about their entire trajectory of how they want to build out. But then I very thankfully have a team that's full of aerospace engineers, mechanical engineers as well, who could be very useful in a lab.
And Nicole, tell us a little bit about Airbus Ventures and what's the relationship with Airbus in particular?
So Airbus Ventures was founded in 2015, and it was really designed to invest in the technologies that we believe will disrupt the aerospace industry. And so our investment thesis is incredibly broad, and it's these technologies that we believe will help the ascension of the Z-axis, which is, we usually have to do like a little bit of an overview of what is the Z-axis, so you know, take us all back to XY plane and all of that.
Yes, yes.
but it was interesting. I don't know if you guys were following the Ingenuity project with the helicopter that was flown on Mars, and it was actually referenced by the NASA director talking about this desire that we all have to exceed the bounds of Earth. And so that's really where we're looking. What that means, nuts and bolts, is investing in technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, rockets, new space, and all kinds of technologies that we think will fit within this to allow these technologies to interconnect from ground to deep space.
And is it a traditional corporate venture capital model, or is it an independent entity that is run as a traditional fund, similar to how Sapphire Ventures does it with SAP, for example?
We're very much an independent and autonomous VC fund, and we're grateful for the Airbus Trust and the pedigree that comes with it. I mean, we certainly share the DNA of Airbus of believing in a global view on technology, a global view on investment. We don't believe that the best technologies are solely located in Silicon Valley. And with that, what that really has meant is that we have structured our most recent fund, we have external investors. So we are very much focused on financial return for those investors, a lot of whom share a passion for aerospace, but we operate autonomously. And the investment decisions are made by the partners at the fund, and we are the folks who are overseeing the portfolio companies.
But it sounds like you leverage the expertise and the know-how of Airbus to do diligence or generate deal flow and things like that, I would imagine, at least.
There's some amount of synergy there. So with the diligence, we do the diligence in-house with Airbus Ventures. We think that's important for IP reasons to ensure that the startup companies feel really comfortable in sharing information with us. Yes. We take the classic Silicon Valley VC approach and how we do the diligence, which is building a large amount of trust in how they're sharing that information. But we certainly have access to thousands of engineers. So if we have specific questions that might be helpful in us making a decision, we might ask that discrete question or get perhaps a perspective as to what that market could look like in the coming years, because that's certainly a huge resource, not only for us, but for the startup companies. So we do use them in that way. But with sourcing, quite frankly, a lot of our deals that we do are and actually complete, they come from co-investor referrals from Silicon Valley and other VC funds that we've partnered with globally. I think that we see a lot of imbalance because folks know that we can do really good, deep technical diligence. And so that's been helpful.
And being that you're global, it sounds like your companies are also spread out all over. Is that the case? How many portfolio companies do you have currently?
Yeah, on average, how many deals do you do per year and ticket size?
So we're tracking above 40 between our active funds that we have right now, as far as the gross number. We probably do on average about 15 transactions per year, but that's initial and follow-on investments because we always reserve for follow-on with our portfolio companies that we invest in. And it is certainly a global mandate. So we are targeting about 60% in North America, 20% in Western Europe and Israel, and 20% in Asia Pacific.
And what stage do you usually get involved in?
Most generally, it's Series A or B, but our fund can go from seed to Series D. And a lot of that is more for the follow-on opportunities, because what we have seen investing in the deep tech, hard tech space is that they might need support for further periods, financially and otherwise. And I think the expertise that we can bring and the understanding of the aerospace sector in particular can be incredibly valuable in those later stage rounds. So we try and keep it fairly broad.
That makes sense. And what sort of trends are you seeing in the focus areas that you had mentioned, particularly what you guys term the Z space?
This is a really exciting sector to be watching. I'm sure you all have seen the SPAC focus in this area in the past 6 to 8 months. And there's a lot of developments that are happening. What we're really interested in is focusing on how these technologies can be done with a clean tech approach. And that's an area that we're really interested in right now, is looking at sustainability in this sector. We made an investment last year in a company called Dendra that is headquartered in the UK, but has major operations in Australia. And this is one that we're really proud of because, as I mentioned, we take a system approach within the team, but we also like to invest in founders who also take a system approach with how they're approaching their technology and their own teams. Susan Graham, who's the founder and the CEO, she has created a company that is looking at how to restore ecosystems in the most efficient way possible. And they've done so using a multi-pronged approach. Right now, some of their biggest customers are mining customers in Australia that have regulatory requirements to restore land if they've used it for mining. And so Dendra's team uses these custom drones to go survey the land, check the weed population, check the ecosystem that's there, and then works with biologists to determine what's the right seed composition to replant the land that's been decimated by mining. And they use custom drones with seed buckets to lay down the seed, and then come back several months later with the drones to go back on the aerial imagery path and review the data and see how to do weed management and other types of restoration and replanting. It all sounds quite basic, but that it's incredibly important, the data that they're collecting. It gets fed into a portal for their customers, who are then using that information in order to restore the land, prepare reports that are going to the Australian government to confirm that they actually have restored the land. And that allows them to essentially get released from bond payments that are incredibly expensive for the mining customers. Right. And we love this because it's such a full stack approach on how to address a problem that we know exists. And the same data is going to be able to be used for carbon credit auditing later on. That's going to be really important for us and with airline customers and the aerospace industry. This is the type of approach that we're really excited about.
And then is there another company or two companies that you also want to highlight that are within the current portfolio?
One in particular we're really excited about and we're really happy for is it's a company called IonQ. We invested them back in 2019, and you may have seen them in the press. They recently announced that they're going to be going through the SPAC process, and that's currently under review. But this team was founded by Jungsang Kim and Chris Monroe, who had this idea for quantum computing, and they were able to onboard Peter Chapman as CEO to take something that often people think of as a lab project into making it commercially available. And that's their focus. So they have been working diligently and having tremendous, it's hard to even describe the progress that they've made technically. I'm trying to be careful just given what's out in the press right now. But what we're pleased with is that they've been able to take this and connect it with Amazon and Microsoft's cloud so that the average person can run an algorithm on it and see what it's like to run a test program on a quantum computer. And so that's really exciting for us. And the reason, just to connect the dot to the Z-axis here, is that for us, if you think about designing an aircraft, it takes about 15 years and $15 billion. And so with the power of quantum computing behind it, we can shorten that time frame. We can get to something closer to market faster. But it's also all of the complex arrangements that are done at airports. I know we've all lost luggage at one point or another. Thinking of all the logistics that go into running an airport, we see a lot of key places for quantum algorithms to facilitate and make our average travel experience better.
One of the risks of investing in venture is always timing. Like, are you too early in the market or too late? With some of these more advanced technologies, there's always the risk of, when is this going to begin to take off? And quantum computing has been discussed for the last 20 years that I can recall, at least, and maybe even more. So how do you guys look at that and you make a bet on a company given the market timing?
Yeah. And for us, that's an imperative. We have a 10-year fund horizon, like I think a lot of VC funds. And so getting that timing right so that the investors are seeing the realization of that in the right time frame is important. For quantum, I think with the IonQ team in particular, it was very clear that they had a path that they saw, both from their technical path to getting to the commercial market that we thought was a viable path. And I think it's going down to that viability. But I'd say another area that we are often asked about that we don't necessarily know the precise answer at this point, what is going to be the timeframe for eVTOLs or flying taxis that everyone talks about being accessible in all of these congested cities? That's a hard thing to time given.
Have you made a bet?
We have not.
You have not. So is that
for exactly that reason?
Okay, got it. Got it. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. If you think about the complexity that goes into understanding when everyone will be comfortable with a flying taxi next to their apartment for privacy reasons, that the city can regulate it. We're sitting in DC. We know how many helicopters are flying around all the time. It's an incredibly complex dance in the sky. And so that's one that we're not quite sure on when that's all going to be unlocked, such that it's feasible for the VC side. But there's a lot of interesting players there right now. And that's one we haven't quite determined what that viable market's time frame is going to look like.
Is there one technology or sector that you think cuts across everything that you do that you're most excited about? And what would that be?
Probably connectivity. That's a sector that we invest in, and it's something that crosses aircraft, it crosses satellites, it goes to that ground to deep space. We know with the satellite constellations that are often discussed that it's incredibly important, given the volume of them that are going to be up there, that there is a communication between them for collision avoidance. So for us, that's probably the one that we see certainly hitting pretty much everything.
You guys call out that your diligence process is tough. So talk to us about what a typical due diligence process looks like for you and your team and what's involved.
So we try, and it puts a lot of pressure on the team because we do want to match the fundraising expectations that folks have. Everyone always wants to do the deal in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So for us, by the time, on average, I would say from the time we've met a founder to investing, we can do it in that short period of time. But we do like to have a longer opportunity to get to know teams if possible. What it generally looks like is we always put basically a group of us from the fund onto doing the diligence on any company that we're going to invest in. So they'll have 3 to 4 folks asking them questions and doing that preliminary diligence. And depending upon what the technology is, we'll pull in any number of experts that we need to make sure that we understand the technology. We take it very seriously that we carry the Airbus brand, and it's important to us that if something or someone is claiming that they have an object that can fly, that it does. And so for us, that's incredibly important that we validated that. And so a couple of weeks with folks grilling them on the tech, the team, and getting to know them, but we can run transactions pretty quickly. So we try and get that right balance between comprehension and speed.
I can validate that you guys are tough in diligence because we invested together, I think, in Astra, right?
So yes, that's correct.
Investors. And so when we looked to invest about a year ago, Chris Kemp was saying how they've been through the ringer with Airbus Ventures and all their technology. We can take it at face value that their technology works.
Well, I hope it wasn't too brutal for Chris. But for us, we take that as a point of pride, that we understand what we've invested in. And with Chris and his team, we've worked really closely with them since that point and in bringing in other folks to help understand them. And then also to essentially spread the news once we are an investor. So I think we've had the opportunity, even with Chris's team, to validate the technology to other folks directly. And we're happy that we can do that.
And what are some of the core investment criteria that you guys utilize?
It really comes to the team. Can that team withstand the G-forces of what they're trying to do? And whether or not that's growing a team from 5 to 80 or going public. We want
to
know
the use of G-forces. That's very on brand.
I was smiling at that as well.
We love a good aerospace metaphor.
As you should.
So I would say for us, that's incredibly important. Do they have what it takes? Do they also have, as mentioned, that system approach? We don't believe that there are solo heroes that can really successfully launch any company. That's one of, obviously, the tech validation. Can it withstand what we've seen? And we've looked at some pretty novel technologies, and we like it when we see these founders who've said, well, there's absolutely no reason why that can't happen via physics. And so that's why we're taking this approach. And so that for us, that's really exciting when we see people doing that. I think, do we know something about the space where we can be a value add? We don't want to just invest and not be able to be an active participant. And so for us, we see it as valuable if we have a grasp of the technology. Admittedly, quantum computing, we're still probably daily trying to read up on it and get smarter. We internally, as a team, do deep dives on tech thrust and constantly trying to improve our understanding of various sectors. And we use that to feed into our scouting and sourcing. If all of those things resonate, that's part of it. And then also good validation from prior co-investors is important for us too.
What do you think is the future of venture capital as a global business? Obviously, the world is becoming more entrepreneurial in totality, whereas 30 years ago, the US was the center of startup innovation, the startup economy. I think you're seeing that everywhere. Do you think that that is something that will continue to happen? And how should a future progressive venture firm look at that trend? And how do you take advantage of it?
We sit in a very privileged seat with the global team and the global mandate. And what we have certainly observed is that a lot of countries are trying to emulate the VC ecosystem that exists in the US because it allows for so many opportunities to be unlocked earlier. And so by that, I mean, we have investments in Japan, and there's a lot of players in that space, including several of our investors in our own fund, who are trying to create an environment which allows VC and startups to flourish. And whether that's access to funding by the government, which we know in the US, there's a lot of opportunities there for technologies that fit within key priorities of the US, and that's hugely beneficial. We've observed in Canada, there's a lot of opportunities there for government support on leases, things that make it feasible to operate an early stage company easier. And so we certainly believe that VC will continue to become more and more global. And that's going to look like a few things. It's going to look like companies flipping to different countries where they see opportunities for more contracts. We often have companies that we've invested in other countries talk to us about how they can set up an entity in the US to sell to the US government, to sell to US commercial players, how they can hire teams in here, and vice versa. Germany has a huge amount of engineering talent. So we see folks who are setting up offices there in order to sell to the European government. So I think it's going to be driven by opportunities for funding, and whether that's non-dilutive funding or VC funding or talent or commercial contracts, I think we're going to continue to see that. I think we're also seeing that there's so much talent globally, and we really can't expect that we're going to be in a silo world. I think if anything, this past year has shown us how interconnected we are, I think in a lot of different ways, but it's also allowed for people to work more collaboratively across time zones. And so from our perspective, you'll continue to see it. And maybe it'll be in a structure like ours, or maybe it'll be like other VC funds who sometimes set up a specific fund in that country. But from our perspective, we think it's better to diversify within one house.
Got it. So at this point, we're going to transition to our segment of our standard questions, where we ask you questions in an attempt to get to know you better. And so we're looking forward to your answers. The first question is our National Venture Capital Association question. The NVCA advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there's one thing that you would change about the venture capital industry or one policy you would advocate for, what would that be?
First, I want to say a massive thank you to the NVCA because I've participated in a lot of their trainings and educational opportunities, in particular with respect to CFIUS. And I think the NVCA has done a tremendous job trying to educate the US representatives, US agencies on what the benefit to the US is with VC here.
And for those that don't know what CFIUS is,
the Committee for Foreign Investment in the United States, that oversees and reviews investments into companies, whether it be through M&A or minority investments where you're also getting a board seat or have a larger check size that might allow you to glean information about that company. And we respect and understand why CFIUS was reformed. It was incredibly important to us to see that there is a focus on making sure that there is IP retention in the United States by those startup companies. And I think that was a key motivating factor was IP theft and corporate types of espionage that were inappropriate through venture capital. And so from our perspective, we think this was really important. And so what we'd like to see, maybe not change, but continue, which is the education piece on how VC can be used to support what we think is really important, which is focusing on these key technologies that quite frankly fit within US national security priorities and the industrial policies that we're starting to see come out of the new administration. We think VC has an important role to play in bolstering those technologies. And so I think there's a little bit sometimes of a misunderstanding on how VC works. And we'd like that education process to continue.
Our second question, and my favorite, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have?
So mine would be a vineyard owner, for sure. But I think unfortunately that requires a lot more money.
I love that.
One of my interests / hobbies is wine. I took my first level sommelier certification a few years ago and try and do blind tastings whenever I can. So I just think it's a fun passion project. But
I know what we're going to do when we get together in D.C.
Absolutely.
I know exactly what we're doing.
Can we take advantage of your skills?
As well. Yes.
Third question is, who is someone you look up to and why?
Okay, hands down, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The notorious RBG must be mentioned. I saw her once in DC at a play, and a hush fell over the crowd when this small woman walked into the play. And I think, I mean, you can't talk about the current status of women in this country without her work that she did, especially focused on equal opportunities. So I have to go with the notorious.
Definitely. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
That it's important to get out of your own way. I think it's myself and other people around me and some of the founders we work with can be overthinkers and overplanners. And sometimes it's really important to go with instinct and to follow your intuition, but also in paying attention to the inputs that are coming from around you from trusted resources. I think sometimes people get too wedded also to ideas and fail to kind of see the broader picture. Someone once gave me that advice when I was overthinking, and I often go back to that.
That's great.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great speaking with you, and we really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.